Thank you for joining us for Innovations in Digital Book Technology, Brainstorming Textbook Applications. Please welcome Dan Oha, June Parsons, Laura Frost, and Al Trujillo.
Welcome. In this session, we're going to try to get you to think a little bit beyond current digital publishing technology, thinking not what a digital textbook is today, but what it could be, what it should be, what it might be in the future. And I've spent most of my time working on technology for digital publishing. The technology is a vital part of that, but I think it's very important that technology people alone shouldn't be making the decisions and setting the course where things go in the future. As textbook authors, you guys know what needs to happen within the textbook. You presumably have a very good feeling for what students need and what instructors need. And part of my thought is that we'll get better digital textbooks in the future if more people are involved in that, people besides just the programmers and the technology people. These things need to make sense from an educational perspective, from a content perspective, from a business perspective. Now, as an author, publishers might not always ask for your input or want your input about digital publishing, is one of the questions from the earliest one. But still, I think we can think about it, we can try to present our opinions, we can try to, in some small way, influence where things go so that the books that we're using 5 years or 10 years from now are better than what we're using today instead of being worse. And to kind of set the stage, I thought I'd start with a little outline of what I see digital textbooks as being now or possibly being. And there's a few things that they all have in common. First, pretty much I think any digital textbook is going to include some text. There will be words. And there's going to be some basic capabilities. You're going to be able to navigate. You can probably search. There's probably text-to-speech capability. But digital textbooks, of course, can go way beyond that. You can include photos or illustrations like you clean in a paper book. Then you can include media, and the media would be things like video, like sound links. Web links would be part of a media type. But beyond media, you can do more. If you think of interactive elements, a student watches a video. It's a very passive process. Student listens to a sound. But it's possible to create interactive things where a student works with the content. You type in an answer. You see if you got the correct answer. Maybe you're matching things, flashcard exercises. Those, a few years ago, would primarily be done in Flash. Now have to be done in HTML. But those that interactive capability can add a lot of educational value to the textbook, even though it's not necessarily delivering content. It's the educational value of what you're trying to do. Learner feedback can be a big part of digital textbooks. And one of the problems with paper books is that they don't give the reader or the student an easy way of determining if they understood what they just read. We try to do that with questions at the end of the section or questions at the end of the chapter. We print the answers upside down or something, and the student is supposed to check that. Motivated students use those things, but maybe some of the students who are less motivated find that too much work. With digital books, we can make it easier. We can provide questions and feedback so the student can fairly easily check to see, this section that I just read looks like I understand it, or it looks like I really wasn't paying attention, I was listening to the radio, or doing Facebook or whatever. But beyond learner feedback, there's also the opportunity for assessment, which would be scored things, quizzes, tests. And in my mind, learner feedback and assessment, there's a thin line between them. I'm not quite sure where one ends and one starts. Assessment things presumably have to have a score. Learner feedback things may or may not be scored, but I find both of those to be very useful. In other words, in creating digital textbooks, my thought would be not everything needs to be scored. Some things are there just to help the learner evaluate whether or not they learn something. Return of results to instructors. One of the most valuable things a digital book can do is provide the instructor with feedback as to what's going on in the class, which students are doing their homework, which students are doing well, which students are running into trouble, so that the instructor has time to intervene before it's hopeless. You can't wait till the midterm. You can't wait till the final and rescue that student. paper books can't really provide that sort of feedback. Digital books can, if we curate them correctly. Now, there's some features of digital books which may be a bit more controversial, or there's maybe less general agreement about those features. One of those is activity statements or activity streams. And I've done a lot of work with that. There's a technology called Tin Can or Experience API. When you use this technology, you can say, this student went to page 2. This student watched video X. This student looked at page 2 for 2 minutes and 45 seconds. This student clicked this link. There is some use to some of that information, but I think also there are some potential drawbacks. One is the privacy issue. If you're collecting a lot of information, can you secure that information? Can you keep it safe? There's also the question of whether or not instructors actually have a use for a lot of the information. I don't know if it makes much difference if we know that Joe spent 2 minutes on page 3, Charlie spent 5 minutes, and is there any real difference? Maybe Charlie took a break. I mean, I don't know. The fact that we can collect information doesn't mean that it's useful and doesn't perhaps maybe mean that we should collect it. Another area which is, I think, sends us on many different paths is adaptation of content. In my mind, educational content or textbook is a guided path through a subject. And you as the author, you're starting with something in chapter 1, in chapter 2 you're continuing, chapter 3 you're going somewhere else. As the author of a traditional book, you determine that sequence, that path that the student takes. It's possible to design digital textbooks which are adaptive. So depending what the student does here, then they'll get to a separate place, they might skip over some content, bring in other sorts of content. Done well, that could be very useful. Done incorrectly, perhaps it brings into question your ability as a subject matter expert to make sure they have a good path, a guided path. There's a lot of issues involved in that one. One of the concerns is that if the student accidentally answers correctly or incorrectly, you want to make sure that then the system isn't assuming that they know about something just because they accidentally got an answer right. And it's very hard. Those systems are very tricky to create. Okay. Freedom of use is another issue. For a paper book, pretty much as long as you have light, you can use that book. There's no restrictions. When you get to a digital book, if the digital book is created to work on iOS devices, Android devices, on certain things, then there's more limitation placed on when or where or which students can use it. There's potential problems there. I lean towards systems, digital books that you can use on everything. But those are hard to make. It's much easier to make digital books that only work in certain environments. Another common way is whether the digital book can only be used while you're online, is if it's web-based, browser-based. That's easier to deliver than a book that's also local, but it puts, again, restrictions on the student. And I think there's issues. Again, paper books don't have those limitations. You use the book any place, any time. Another area that I think I worry about a lot is coexistence with paper books. I think it's clear, paper books are not going away. 10 years from now, 20 years from now, there will still be paper books. They're going to be a significant part of the market. Digital books will also be some part of the market, and we don't know how the percentage will shape out. But it seems fairly clear that you're going to have mixed classes. In a class, you might have 20 students using the paper book, 10 students using the digital book. If there's not some parity between that content, we create a real problem. Now, there's some things that a paper book will never be able to do. It can't show videos, so you have to point them to some auxiliary resource. But I worry if we can't provide some parity between those experiences that maybe we're going into a direction which is less than optimal. I also worry about production processes because, in the end, the publishers have to make money. Because if they don't make money, they won't stay in business, they won't pay us, none of us will be very happy. It's simply not feasible to put a large investment in development of a paper book plus a separate large investment for development of the digital book, new layout and a huge process, that's not sustainable. So I hope that over time we're going to be finding systems where you can do one book and it works for paper, works for digital, and you have the thing without dramatic extra costs. Because if there are high extra costs for digital for publishers, they're going to want to take that money out somewhere. It's going to affect us in some way. And The next one, which actually concerns me a bit, is the ability to adapt to books continuously. And I think June mentioned this in her earlier ones. With digital, it's possible to create books that can be changed quite regularly. You can make updates to it weekly, monthly, if you like. I'm not sure if that's always advantageous, and I'm fairly sure that many instructors don't really want that. Instructors don't want to look foolish. So if something is in the book, and then you change the book on the next week, and it's no longer that, and the student points it out, they don't look very knowledgeable about their subject. So I think, again, the fact that we can, that it's possible to modify books quickly doesn't necessarily mean that's a thing that we're going to want to do. Okay? So in that realm of things of what a digital book could be, which might be delivered in many different ways, having videos, having interactive exercises, telling the instructor how the student is doing, what they're doing well, alerting the instructor about problems, adapting to student needs, somewhere out of all of those is going to become the textbook that we're going to be using in 10 years and 15 years and 20 years. Now, related to that, then we came up with a series of questions that we thought we'd discuss, and we all have actually fairly different backgrounds, and I'll give these guys a chance in a moment to explain their backgrounds and where they're coming from. And we thought that for the first part of this is that we would discuss the questions, us on the panel, and we'll provide some different perspectives on these questions. We were not necessarily going to give answers. I think our discussion will raise more questions, but that's okay. Then, for the second part of that, what we'll do is we'll give you an opportunity to ask questions. We'll take a shot at answering if we know, or if any of you can answer them, we'll answer those questions. So as we go for the first part, we'll do the discussion part first, but if you can make notes of any questions that you'd like to ask, then we're going to reserve the last half for questions that you guys ask, and we'll all try to address them and see if we can come up with anything. Okay, maybe for the first thing, if we can give the folks on the panel a chance to give you some context, some background as to what they've done with digital textbooks, so you know kind of where we're coming from. Do we want to start? Okay, actually, why don't you take that one? If you turn the green.
Okay. So Dan had asked us to think about a couple of things to introduce ourselves. What's our experience been with digital textbooks? Mine has been very little, I guess. I think like many people who have written a textbook, you've got an e-textbook that's in PDF format that is flying around out there and has a few sales every year. My experience is similar to that. That's my experience with digital textbooks. But along with the paper textbook, there's a lot of digital pieces that are learning tools that go along with it. So online homework, for example, test bank, that's also digital. So I was trying to create things that fell into this category since I only had the PDF experience. There's other in-class assessment tools that are also digital, pre-class assessment tools. What do we think works well? I think the e-homework in general seems to work well. I think faculty like assigning it, and I think that it's something that is useful for them because they don't have to grade as much homework. So there's a benefit to faculty.
Actually, I'm not sure if I know what e-homework, what you mean by e-homework.
Oh, it's an electronic homework.
What is it?
Sorry, that's kind of obvious, I guess. So it's the questions from the textbook. There's also some other questions that show up in the chapters. In Mastering Chemistry is one that's with my textbook. So, you know, a faculty member can assign questions and they can be automatically graded. So then the students get grades from the homework. Okay. Sorry, I didn't, we're in our own little worlds and we don't know that other people don't know what those things are, I guess. Sorry. What doesn't work well was another question that Dan had asked us to think about. And Al and I were actually talking at lunch about this, is what doesn't work well is sometimes the other questions that are in the homework platform that don't necessarily come from your textbook but are on the same topics don't deliver it the same way. And so a student might not have even heard the term because you don't use it in your book, and it's a question that they're supposed to be able to answer, and they can't. And so you might get bad analytics from that because they just didn't answer it because it's not something that's in your book, but it's in the same realm. The other thing that doesn't work well in my mind is not being able to review a lot of the ancillaries. I just remember, I'll tell one story about the first edition of my textbook. I looked at the test bank, and some of the questions that were being asked weren't even covered in the book. And it was already published, so I didn't have, couldn't do anything about that. So, you know, those were just things. What's on the wish list was the last part of this. I think the primary author or authors have to be involved in what those digital pieces are that are going with your book. That's my thought on that.
Hi, everybody. I'm Al Trujillo, and I teach at a community college near San Diego called Palomar College. I'm the author of an oceanography textbook. And for my digital experience, my book is offered as a e-format textbook that's associated with the online resources, like Laura. My publisher is Pearson Education, and they offer Mastering, and with that, students can purchase a subscription to an e-textbook. My textbook is also offered in an iPad and a Kindle format, and so those are also available to students to purchase. The purchase of those is actually for a subscription of a certain time frame, which currently is 18 months. So it allows them to use the book for the semester and subsequent semesters should they choose to re-enroll to replace a bad grade. Also, Pearson has done a lot of work with how students use textbooks and looking at the kinds of things that students do as they read. And students are very connected to social media, and so they have their cell phone there. And so one of the ideas was to put that cell phone to educational use. So within my book, there are QR codes, which are those little black and white boxes that you see like in magazines and maybe on the sides of buses, that you scan that with an app on your smartphone and it takes you directly to a site. So we have built animations or short videos that are associated with content, and then students can actually scan that with their smartphone and use that to help them understand the material. So those are my main experiences with that. And I think that's all I want to do for an introduction right now. But
okay, hello again. June Parsons. When I was 8 years old, my father was the Associate Dean of Education at Michigan State University. And I remember one evening, he took me down to the campus, and they had a kind of modernistic Kiva building, they called it, which was like an amphitheater, and the students would sit in this amphitheater, and they would watch demonstrations so they could see how kids learned. And there was a gadget in the middle of the Kiva, which I sat down at. And it turned out that it was one of the old Plato systems, which is a programmed learning system, one of the first ones for computers. And that system was set up as a adaptive system. Basically, what happened was a paragraph of text appeared on the screen. The student would read the paragraph of text, and that was followed by one or two questions. And answering the question correctly took you to another screen, and answering the question incorrectly took you somewhere else. So this was way, way back when. Jump forward, 1995? Yes. Dan and I worked on the first interactive multimedia digital textbooks that was available through an established publisher. It was called the New Perspectives on Computer Concepts, and it was provided on CD. It was the full content of the book, digital, with illustrations or diagrams that came to life as animations, and photographs that came to life, so to speak, as videos. There were end-of-section quizzes, and there were end-of-chapter practice tests that students could take as many times as they wanted. The questions were pulled from a test bank of about 250 questions per chapter, and the quizzes or the practice tests were, what, were they 15 questions each? Something like 10 questions, something like that. So students had ample opportunity to practice. We also had a series of labs that Dan designed. So they were simulated software labs. So even if students didn't have Microsoft Office, for example, they could learn how to use Microsoft Office using the labs. So that was 1995, and we continued to work on the technology for those books and improve the technology, put it on the cloud, put it on iPads, basically every platform that's available. I learned a lot, not only about pedagogy as I watched students use the books, but I learned a lot about layout because I did my own layout for the textbooks. And I learned a lot about animations because we did our own animations. And I learned a lot about scripting because I did the scripting for all of the animations too. And then I learned about digital photography because we took a lot of our own photos. And we learned about digital videography because we did the videos. And the latest tool that we've used is called VideoScribe, which is a very cool tool. You know, when you see the hands writing on the screen, yeah, they write, and then little pictures zoom into view. That there are several tools that you can use to do that. One of them is VideoScribe. So, yeah. So, kind of, I've been fortunate that I've been able to, with Dan, kind of say, hey, wouldn't this feature be the greatest thing to put in the textbook? I mean, wouldn't this really benefit students? And he sits down at his computer and taps away, and voila, a new feature is added to the textbook platform. So I've been able to explore, I think like maybe no one else has been able to explore, the realm of putting your words, your textbooks, your image, your design into the reality of digital. So that's kind of my experience.
And just a little background for me. I co-authored many computer textbooks with June, but then I spent most of my time developing software, starting with testing systems, animation systems, all sorts of things. But lately, like the last 10, actually about the last 18 years, working mostly on digital publishing systems, trying to solve some particular problems. First, how can you quickly take existing content, convert it to digital, add all sorts of media elements, interactive elements to that, and deliver it as many ways as possible? And it's got to be quick, because if it's not quick, it starts costing you money. So basically, we're looking at trying to do that in days, less than a week, even for a very large book, very, very fast. Output it every way, meaning every way, trying to make something so it'll run from a web server in a browser on almost any device. Making it so it'll run locally on Mac or Windows. Make it so it'll run locally on Android devices. Run locally on iOS devices. Lately, we've been doing a lot of work with our partners in emerging markets. Started in India, Pakistan, the Mideast. Now they're doing a lot of work, a lot of focus on Africa. But where they have very unique technology challenges in trying to basically make sure we can deliver our content even under the most rudimentary of conditions, meaning they might have one computer in a classroom and a screen or a projection device, and that's their total facility. We can work there. They might have a local area network and a bunch of devices, cheap Android tablets that they connect to it. We can put our content there. They might have a local area network that sometimes got connection to the internet, but it's not very fast. We can work on that if they have fast internet work there. But to try to deliver that content very easily in whatever environment they happen to have. A crucial part of it is getting results back to instructors, because in my mind, the biggest advantage is digital textbooks should be able to get scores and send those back. It's trickier to get them back to the instructor than you think, because in the context like of the textbooks we've done for Cengage, we don't know who's going to purchase that book, and we don't know where they are, and we don't know what system they're going to be using. So I need to be able to make a product, some student in Iowa buys it, and I've got to get his results back to their instructor. But if a student in the UK buys it, I've got to get the results back to his instructor. I don't know either of them ahead of time. And so you end up developing systems to handle that, because we don't depend on it going back to a particular system. So it's basically those sorts of issues. The last one I'm working now is curriculum matching. If you have a library of tens of thousands of modules and you want to match to the curriculum of a particular school somewhere in the Middle East, how can you collect all those modules and produce a package that you ship to that school and do that fairly quickly? And so there's all these technical challenges. I've actually been having fun doing it. Okay, so that's what we've done. Now we'll start with some of the questions that we've tossed some questions around, things that might help you think of digital publishing and the potential of it in different ways. And we decided to start with a fairly straightforward, concrete question, and this is, if you're working on a digital textbook project, how do you decide when you need to do use something other than text? If you want to use a video or an animation, an interactive element, how would you come to that decision? How would you decide what to do?
Okay, well, I'm starting. And I guess the way that I decide is through my own experience teaching the topic. Because, most of us have taught, according to your survey in the last session, we've been teaching 10, 20, sometimes more years than that. And if you've taught your subject, you know which topics your students are going to have the most trouble with. And those are the ones they need the most help with. And so those are the ones that I choose to put more effort into as far as things that you might want to make a video on or ask more homework questions about.
I think I would do pretty much the same, except with one addition. The things that they have trouble with, plus looking at the cost, whenever possible, if you can do something in words, use words. They're cheap. If you can do something with a picture illustration, use that. That's the next cheapest. If you need to use a video or non-interactive animation, then do that, but understand that's going to cost quite a bit more. More time, more money. And if you need to do an interactive element where they're actually manipulating something, be careful, because that may cost you even more. So I tend to look at what the thing that they need to do, where the difficulty is, and also look at, make sure you really need to do that element for it, because media and interactive things cost money. Text is cheap. Use words as much as you possibly can. But sometimes words aren't good enough, and then you've got to do something else.
So maybe 10 editions ago, my publisher said to me, "You need to have a picture on every page." You know, okay. So if you're working with a print book and you're working with a page format, today's students do need some kind of visual. If they're faced with a whole page full of text, they will not read it. So a picture is a good idea, or some kind of image, a graphic. But if you're working with digital, a lot of times the digital is not page-oriented. So I don't know, for example, Cengage's MindTap system is section-oriented. So students, let's say you have a section, maybe your chapter is divided into sections, or perhaps your chapter is maybe 8 pages long. That would be a chunk. So a student would see that on the screen as one long scrolling piece of text. All right. So I think we have to think not only of what's useful for students pedagogically, but we have to also understand our students' psychology in looking at the text itself. And our students are now the students who are used to 142 characters. the length of a tweet, which is about 3 sentences per paragraph and not a very wide line width. No, I'm not kidding, because this is their attention. They can read that, and they can read maybe 2 paragraphs, and then what is it? TLDR? Too long, didn't read. It's a social media thing. If you see TLDR, that's what that means. So we as authors have to be cognizant of that, right? Of how much our students, how long their attention span is. It's about 3 seconds.
I have one comment that I remembered about, or it brought to my mind as June was talking, and that is a recent study that was done about the differences between digital textbooks and print textbooks. And when students try to remember things, they often have a visual image of what that information looked like on the page. And that's why the illustrations on the page are key to triggering memories. And that's one of the things that you lack sometimes in a version of a digital textbook, because it's more like one long form, and it's hard to pick out the important parts. So it's actually more beneficial to have a paper copy because of those visual clues of what the pages look like, that if students can remember them, it helps them answer the questions correctly.
One of our later questions will kind of get right to that, I think, of interesting. But following up on the first one, what role can and should an author play in development of a digital textbook? Should authors help identify places where video animation would be useful, or should they leave those decisions up to the publisher or the digital textbook team?
Well, I think it's your content, so you ought to be involved in what content gets put in digitally.
Yeah, I think with that, the author should be involved, but I've never really been asked about those kinds of decisions. I wish I were involved with that, and I think that's something that we can all try to press harder for as authors.
Yeah, my take on that is somebody's going to decide what goes in there, and the author is the person who best understands the content, where the difficult part might be, what's going to be helpful. I'd really like to have the author have a say in that, if at all possible. Next question, how do you feel about data going back to instructors? Should instructors get data on usage as a time spent watching a video? Should some activities just be for learner feedback, or should all results go back to the instructors? And a follow-up, how do you feel about usage data going back to publishers?
Yeah, so with the current edition of my textbook, this is the first time that mastering was included with it. And with mastering, you can get all this analytical data from how long students spend on a page, how many times they submit an answer before they get the right one, whether they requested the hint, whether they ended up just giving up. So there's all this really rich data about that. And for the new edition that I'm working on for my textbook, my editor gave me that information. And what he wanted me to do with that is to analyze it. It is pages upon pages upon pages upon pages of data. And he wanted me to analyze it and to figure out trends and to see questions where students struggled. And then that would then pinpoint me to areas of the text that need to be rewritten, that need to be have maybe an additional figure, an animation, some kind of additional media to help them more successfully answer those questions. But in the end, what I realized was that it really pointed out the questions that were poorly worded in that online resource rather than identifying parts of the text that really needed to be rewritten. So it's almost like too much information. It's a real chore to go through. And it is kind of surprising that the editor really wanted me to go through all this and to try to figure out trends.
But I'm surprised, pleasantly surprised, that at least they thought that they would want to give you that data and see if you could do something with it.
I think that the first part of the question was, how do you feel about the data going back to the instructors? I think it's perfectly fine to give them the data. My question is will they? I wonder how many of them actually look at much of it. I mean, they really are just concerned about getting the grades to of if it's a homework, you know, as if they're really, you know, if they're good practice, if they're practicing good practice, they would be interested in that. But I mean, you know as well as I do, a lot of times you're teaching four courses and they're all different, and you don't have a lot of time to go looking at the analytics of your online homework.
Actually, maybe if we could ask you to raise your hands, if you, as an instructor or the instructors that you know that use your book, how many would like to see results in the scores of things that students are doing? And how many would like to see usage data, like they watched this video or they did this thing? Okay, so some. Maybe as a some follow-up on the second part, we can talk a little bit about how you'd use that and what you'd like to see, because I think that's it's, if they're going to be collecting data, it should be data that you'll find useful. Right?
So there's one other thing that worries me a little bit about this data collection thing. I don't know if instructors are necessarily prepared to use that data. And let me just give you an example. So say that you get some information that you have one student in the course, and that student spent 3 hours on a section, and after repeated tries, they finally got 90% on the assessment. And then you have another student who spent 10 minutes on the material and got 85% on the assessment. Do you make, what kind of, as an instructor, what kind of conclusions do you draw from that data? I mean, do you draw, oh, this one guy is kind of stupid, but man, he is trying really hard and he's scored okay. And then the other one kind of blew it off, but well, you know, he got it off. You know, if we're just looking at the assessment results, we don't get that background data. And I just am not quite sure that we know what to do with that background data, or if we really know how to use that effectively. Or in a sense, if I'm a student, I'm wondering if it's any of your business as the instructor or the author, if you know all that stuff about me.
Okay, next question was, oh, sorry, did you? Next question was, what role, if any, should a page play in digital textbooks? Is the page still relevant? If we don't use pages, what kind of chunks, what segments are we delivering content in?
Okay, so we kind of addressed this earlier. It seems to me that cognitively students do have some spatial learning that goes on with the page. Don't you think so? It makes lots of things make a difference about layout, the line width, the leading, the spacing, the amount of white space that you have on the page, the size of your illustrations. I mean, there are all kinds of design factors that can make your textbook more or less effective. And all of those things, or many of those things, depend on a page layout. When you just start to dump that all into a stream of text and then some pictures come a little later, I think you lose a lot of that important spatial information.
I'll add one thing, and that is that cognitive science says that you're not going to hold any more in your short-term memory than about 10 or 20 minutes, depending on how motivated you are to learn the material. So you're down at 10 if you really hate the course, and you're up at 20 if you like the course. And if you really love the course, maybe you can get a little more than 20 minutes worth. So, you know, I wouldn't put more on a page than somebody could absorb in 20 minutes.
Part of my thought on that is that textbooks over a very long period of time have evolved to have fairly complex page layouts. We're very careful about where the callouts appear and where the text, and that the leading text comes first, and if there's an illustration, it usually comes after it. And it seems that if someone says that the digital textbook doesn't need that or can't support it, my feeling is, well, you've got a problem with your digital textbook, because if that layout of the page is important in a paper book, I fail to see how it's not important on a digital book. This, the page
to me, is part of the educational content. It's part of the value. If we throw that away when we move to digital, I think we're losing something fairly fundamental. And I hate to see that go away just because some technologies can't handle it. I mean, it's like we're in the Model T stage of digital books. I mean, it's what I work on, but we're in the early days. I think we have to make sure we don't throw away the important things in order to gain some small things, right? Okay, next question. And this I spend a lot of time thinking about things and worrying. Thinking larger, is the idea of a book still relevant? Or maybe content should be presented in smaller chunks, or maybe bigger chunks, or maybe if you go to a digital book with a lot of assessment, learner feedback and results for instructors, maybe at some point that book becomes a digital course. It's no longer something to be used as part of the course, it's the entirety of the material. I don't know what's going to become, is going to make more sense to do small chunks, big chunks, giant chunks. You guys, what do you think about chunk size?
Yeah, that's one of the things that for the current edition of my textbook they had me do. And the idea and the phrase my editor used was to chunk it out, because their studies show that our students today don't read a whole chapter. I remember reading a book like that. I remember setting aside 3 hours to go from the page one of this chapter all the way through and answer the questions at the end. That's not how our students read. So to chunk it out means to take maybe to break it up into smaller modules or chunks that are maybe 2 or 3 pages. And that's the kind of time that our students are actually focused on that, if we're lucky that we get that kind of time commitment for that. And so it's more module, it's more shorter chunks, and the end of the chapter questions are no longer there. They're embedded within the chapter to allow that whole chunk, that whole section, to stand alone as is.
So, oh yeah, okay, in the 2 editions ago, I made a change to the pedagogy that I put in my digital book. And so 800-page textbook on technology, chapters 50 pages long. But each chapter divided into 5 sections, so then you're down to a 10-page thing with a picture on every page so that it's manageable. And at the end of each of those sections, there's a quiz. But what I added was this. I added something that I call quick checks. So on every page where there is an important concept, there is a quick check after that concept is presented. So students read a paragraph, maybe 2, and then there's a quick check question that checks to see, are you paying attention? Did you get what you just read? So back to Plato, which is a couple of paragraphs on the screen, with then some questions to assess your knowledge. You know, educators back in the 60s were experimental, but I think they did some very in-depth research on learning, and there were some very, very astute educators in those days. Not to say that there aren't now, but there were. And so that... Although Plato, I mean today, right, I'm not advocating Plato because that was kind of boring. But where were we? Pages, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, are they relevant? So yeah, I think they are really relevant.
I've been kind of directly involved in this on a number of projects recently, and I think maybe the optimal chunk size might depend somewhat on the market and the level. Our partners are doing a lot of work in emerging markets, and for there, where they're doing focusing primarily K-12, the smaller modules allow them to match local curriculums very easily. But I think that could be troublesome when you get something like a college-level textbook, where basically you've got a lot of content and you're taking them on a very complex tour through the subject. Chunking that out could be more difficult. So I'm not sure if I'm right, but my gut feeling is that maybe as we look at higher-level textbooks and more in-depth subjects, maybe longer chunks are better. And as we look at lower levels and simpler subjects, maybe shorter chunks are better. But maybe that's wrong. I don't know.
Well, I think the reason that they're in shorter chunks at younger ages is because they can't process as much information. And as you get older, you can process more information up into adulthood.
And so there's a, like a session size. Is that what you're saying?
Okay.
Maybe what Dan was saying was that the information on the higher level, there's a lot more dependencies on previously learned information, perhaps, then so that may need to be a little more structured and maybe longer sequences.
Well, I think maybe I'm thinking there is related to that is on the like the computer textbooks. How you explain a topic in Chapter 4 depends on what you already presented in Chapters 1, 2, and 3. If I take Chapter 4 out of context, I don't know what that person does or doesn't know what I've already introduced. Some subjects don't have those dependencies, and it doesn't really matter. But some subjects, it's heavy. Math isn't my area, but I suspect math is very much like that. Yeah, maybe spelling, for example, is not. It's discrete groupings, and who cares? You can chunk it how you like. So maybe it also is level and the type of subject. Next question that I had was, how often should the content of digital textbooks should be updated? Are editions obsolete? Do instructors really want textbooks that are constantly updated? Is it practical to continually update a textbook and all the related material, such as the questions and the videos and the animations and the ancillary content?
Yeah, you know, I think you made a good point earlier. If you're continually updating, then that can really confuse the instructor because they don't know what version of the digital textbook that a student may have. They may have downloaded it at one point, doesn't have those updates. It's important to be current, of course, but with world events that occur in some of the textbooks that we write that we need to have the most current information, you might refer to, open your book to page 42. And for different versions of the book, including the print versions, that would be an entirely different page. So that's a concern with that.
When we get to the next part, some of you folks might have some strong opinions about that part. Can you hold your question until we do the next part? Because I'd like to get your input on that, because I think some people may have definite opinions. Next question that we had is about what sort of additional content or a module should accompany a digital textbook? Here we're thinking of things like test banks, exercises, simulations, videos, and how should those be delivered to students? Meaning, do they need to be part of the book? Are they a separate thing? Are they a separate purchase? If the author creates additional content, how should they get paid for that work? If someone other than the author or publisher creates that content, how should that work? Because in a sense, if you can think of like cliff notes for books, for textbooks, digital question sets and that sort of thing, anybody can create those. And I don't know where all of this goes as we have all of the ancillary contents. Any thoughts on that?
So we both have mastering our science, whatever, your oceanography, mastering chemistry that come along with the textbooks. They can be bundled with or the students can purchase them separately. This is the online homework systems. It's a great question. If the author creates additional content, how do they get paid for that work? I don't know if it, you know, I guess the concern that I have is if the questions that come with my book that I wrote are in the digital platform and those are the ones that are getting used and not the other ones that are in there, I just gave the content to that digital piece. I mean, that digital piece does sell textbooks, and so that's what the publisher, you know, says is, well, that's driving your textbook market. And for now, that's the only way that we're doing it. But as we move more into digital, we're creating more digital content, which isn't part of the original contract with writing a textbook. And I'm just wondering where we're going to go. I don't have an answer at all.
Yeah, for me, I've created a series of videos. Like what Laura was talking about earlier, how do we know what to really focus on? And by our experience in the classroom, we know the topics that our students struggle with. So to try to address that, I've created some short videos to cover things like latitude and longitude on Earth. What does that look like? Why are they different? What does degrees, minutes, and seconds mean? So I've created these short videos, and I post them for free on YouTube for my students. But it's interesting because other students in other courses find them, and sometimes they'll post comments like, gee, my instructor never talked about that, and I sure wish that he would see this video and he could explain it to us that way, you know? So I feel like I'm not looking to get paid for that, but I'm just trying to get information out to maybe the broader oceanographic public or the broader oceanographic group of students that exist to help them in their classes wherever they may be.
So that's also kind of a contract and royalty issue, I think, right? And some publishers will sell a textbook, and then they will sell access to an online site, right? And your royalty, you will get royalties on the textbook, but on their sale to the online site, the access code that they sell, you might not get royalties on that. So you might get royalties on that if you've been a good negotiator. Okay, something to think about.
Or maybe another way of looking at it is a publisher might do as a work for hire, might hire someone to create questions or create videos to accompany the book. That's okay. That's good. But if you as a motivated author create such things, it seems like maybe there should be some equivalent compensation there if you're creating that because you really feel it should exist. And maybe if other instructors wanted to create the stuff that goes with your book, maybe it would be nice if somehow digital could facilitate that. If an instructor at an entirely different institution wants to create videos or questions that go with your book, I mean, it would be nice if there was a way to make that available and reward that instructor for creating that stuff. And it seems like maybe that's one of the things that digital can do is encourage those sorts of markets. I don't know. I think there's opportunities there. Then, our very last question before we let you ask questions. And this is, as you think, I mentioned earlier, but as you think, as digital textbooks become richer, as they move beyond just text and pictures and you add videos, you add interactive things, you have assessment, you're getting results going back, and you have this very, very rich environment that might adapt to the student, tell the student you're weak in this area, let's do some extra exercises. Is there a point where that really stops being a book in the traditional sense and becomes the course? And if that happens, where does that go like for the instructor? And I don't have some concerns of where that happens for compensation. Because if like we're creating what is the course and there's no instructor involved in that thing, maybe we're creating something a little different from a textbook. I don't know. Any thoughts on that?
I have thoughts on everything. I don't think that, you know, the research is kind of clear that we had this experiment a couple years ago with massive open online courses. They're still out there. They're called MOOCs. Lots of people sign up for them. Very few pass them because there's no interaction with any instructor, and I think the research is clear that a hybrid with an instructor guiding the student through the course is much more effective. So I don't think anybody's jobs are in jeopardy in the area of teaching.
Okay, so those were the questions that we had thought might be interesting to present. But now we're very interested in questions that you might have or questions you might have about those things. Now, we won't, of course, necessarily have answers, but you guys maybe will help them answer that. Here she comes.
Little guy. I have a question. And I teach and write in math, okay? So maybe it's a little different. Your assessments. How do you foster higher order thinking skills? If you're going to answer questions with all multiple choice or if you're chunking a question into little tidbits, it's great for killing drill. And when I teach really low level college courses, or pre-college courses actually, it's wonderful. How can you help it for the other thing? You know, for a more difficult course, or even as I progress on. I just don't want, you know, two-second answers. Second thing, and this is a little bit off, in my book, our book, it wasn't me, but I got paid as a work for hire to do the scripts for the videos and for the some of the other stuff for the digital. So that's how it works.
Your question about, because there's some things that are very easy to score. Multiple choice is easy, true, false, short answer is pretty easy. Larger things are very, very hard, and I've spent a lot of time trying to solve that problem, not finding very good solutions. I think that's a really good question. Maybe the best solutions that maybe that I can find is that if the digital environment simplifies the other workload for the instructor, so we take care of all the easy stuff that's easily scored, we get the other things like essay responses back to the instructor, who's going to have to grade them by hand, and we can't speed that up. But at least we can take care of the other overhead. Maybe that's the best that we're going to be able to do. Yeah.
Machine scoreable.
Then you're going to start doing kind of trivial things, and it's, you know, it might be something for second or third grade. It's not what you want to do in 12th grade or at a college level. Yeah, really good question, really hard problem.
So you're talking about the process. I mean, you're kind of, you want to look at the process, for example, in a math problem. You want to see the process that the student used to solve the problem. Is that part of it?
It's more than that. It's when many of these questions actually take it and say, you know, what do you do here? And gives me.
Oh yeah.
And you know, and then it says, yeah, you're right. Now do the next little section. I want you to know. I mean, somebody isn't always there holding your hand. You've got to think through the problem and say, how will I solve this problem? And by doing it in little tiny chunks, it's not teaching a higher order thinking skill. And it might get me an A in this course, but suppose I'm one of those people who really could go further in math and really could be a great PhD. I'll never get there doing it in little chunks.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Good. My concern with digital books is a few things. First, I read a study that said that between print copy and digital, people seem to prefer the print copy because it's easier to navigate through the book. I teach engineering, and I've written books on that subject. And the higher order of books, you'd want to keep a copy of that when you go out into the professional world because it's easy to access and get through. And the young lady here on the right making the comment about students having short attention spans is very, very real. I mean, seriously real. And when you have animations, even that, they look at that as trivial to them because they're just simply interested in getting the homework done and, you know, getting through the course as quick as they can. They're short on time with whatever we do, so we can overkill our digital books if and when we do those. Another issue had to do with the fact that students, when they use a mastering system, which they do with my book also, in engineering, you want students to give homework to you. As a professor, I prefer to see how my students lay out the homework problem and actually execute the solution. In a mastering system, they try to guide you through and find the weaknesses that you've mentioned to get through the system, but you don't get homework back. And the fact that you can't really monitor their writing skills, perhaps, or their way of keeping neat on execution is very important in engineering courses. And so you want to try to have that be the old-fashioned way, I think, simply for that reason. Those are just a few comments I have about all this, but maybe you can throw some more at that.
I don't think digital's the only way to go. I think if you're the instructor, you've got to do those other things. You can't just assign all that homework and that's electronic and not assess other ways.
My take is that digital has the potential to be better than paper, but many haven't been. Many are really awful. So I believe the results, the tests that show that people prefer print. But I would suggest that maybe because we're still doing Model T versions of digital books, and when they get better, then they should be more effective learning tools.
Reading the material to the student rather than him sitting there and staring at the screen and reading it himself. Because to sit down and read something, as someone said about text messages, a few lines is fine, but to sit there and garble through a lot of printed text on an electronic screen is tough. But you've seen books where people get in cars and listen to people talk to them, and that's what you possibly could see happening in the future with them, if anything. And also, they're very easy to pirate. I mean, it's scary. My book is in digital form, and I have students that tell me I just got a copy off the internet just without paying anyone for it, and here it is. And, of course, it's a PDF file now. But anyway.
That's all good comments. Of course, there are many different learning styles that our students have. Some of our students are visual learners. Some of them are auditory learners. And one of our challenges, I think, is to create materials that work for all learning styles. In the past, visual learners have excelled because our textbooks have been visual. Now we have the chance to add some other kinds of media into that mix, and hopefully that will help some of the students who have been underserved in the past.
So I have a comment regarding something June said a moment ago. Here I am behind the post. I've been teaching online for over 12 years, and I have had access to minutes of usage in all of my courses that whole time. And your comment was about 3 hours, 90%, versus 10 minutes and 85%. My experience has been that, like everything else, the interactive, this information, it's a tool, because a lot of the time the students spend, if they're not actively touching their keyboard, it's not accessed. And so they may be putting the seat time in studying. So as a tool, I've found that you have to look at other assignments. I'm sure you know this. How are their discussion posts? How are they interacting? Are they, when they write you emails to complain about how mean you are, how's their grammar? So taking all of those factors in, it's a lot easier to hear a student's voice as they write. In fact, I would go to a residency and hear somebody talking and say, oh my gosh, you're in my, are you stalking me? I said, no, I recognize your voice. How can you recognize my voice? Because you talk exactly like you write. So if you use these other tools and keep it a tool, then the timestamp, it's probably helpful, because if somebody goes in 0 minutes, it's not likely they're going to pass your course. But it's not a given. It's not a given. So that's my comment.
I'm naive and trusting. So back in the 90s, I participated in about a half a dozen animations for LaserDisc, the big LaserDisc. And these were flip charts that got converted. But there was no payment for it. It was considered enhancement of the sale of the book, and I trusted that. Then when we got in the CD era, I think I completed about 55 animations. The other authors did another 40, and with the scripts and everything, and with storyboards. And that was the same reasoning, that it's enhanced sales of your book and so on. Now with the mastering materials, there is a system worked out where the authors are compensated because we have our content on there, including the book. And so that's in place. That's different than the naive trusting days, but that's kind of how the compensation has worked. There was no payment otherwise.
I'm interested in that. If you create extra content to go with your book, you can get paid some percentage of sales or use, or how do they do that? That's very interesting. How are they?
I think it's a 50-50 split on the mastering. Yeah, proportion on the mastering sales.
And they make those things available through the same site and infrastructure, so they're making it visible and available to students?
Oh, yeah.
Good. How would they feel about someone else creating additional content for that? Because that's a whole thing, I think, which we're going to start seeing more of. Or would they, you know, I mean, would they be wanting more people to post auxiliary stuff to go with the book, which seems to me makes the book more valuable, or not wanting? I'm just wondering.
I think on the work for hires for digital content prep, we do try to take into account the author's schedule, right? I mean, it would be great if they were involved in everything, but there's also these really easy schedules that we provide you to publish, right? So anyway, there is that take into account is, you know, is the value of having Professor Christofferson do these videos more important than him spending time on the manuscript? And sometimes a work for hire can actually accomplish the same value, and we can keep him focused on the stuff that a work for hire we wouldn't want to trust with. So I think there's a balance there, but yeah, I mean, there's, at least for me, every project has its own type of situations that we try to accommodate for.
Hi, Susan Burstyn from City College of San Francisco, Junior. Last presentation was well worth my entire trip. Thank you so much. A couple comments about adaptive learning. It lowers the switching costs. So from the standpoint of marketing for publishers, you want to tie the school and the instructor into the adaptive learning. You're selling software as well. It works well, to your point about timestamp, for students who want to succeed and who are overachievers. So my top students are spending many, many, many hours using the adaptive learning tools and trying to maintain and build proficiency. I also count it as 20% of their grade. They're to complete a quiz for each chapter after I discuss it in class. At City College of San Francisco, we have a wide, wide range of knowledge, background, and experience levels. And I want to talk to your point about time spent. My ESL students who do not speak English are spending many, many, many hours with far less proficiency than my native speakers who are studying the material before and then spending probably one-fourth to a third of the time doing the initial assessment. So there's a lot of different ways to really look at it, and it's not a one-size-fits-all, and it's certainly not perfect, but all of the topics that you've brought up today are super, super interesting, and it's evolving, and I think many professors are slow to adopt the technology, but there is value. You have to look at it as maybe supplemental and as complementary, and it certainly works well in a hybrid environment and in a flipped classroom model as well. But thanks so much, guys. You too, Dan. Really, really so interesting.
I'm going to come right back to you. I actually have a question. Okay. A real question here. I would like to start using electronic books, and in addition to writing one. How, if you have it in the classroom, how do you keep the students from flipping onto Facebook, ordering their shoes on Amazon? How do you keep them with a computer in front of them without, with in focus? So getting them to go to page 4. I'd love some strategies on that.
Great question. I'll tell you what I do, and I don't know how successful it is, because when the students have that laptop front open, you have no idea what they're looking at. So in my classes, what I require is anybody who's going to use a laptop, and that's been increasing over the years. I'd say maybe now 30 to 40% use either a Surface or a laptop to take notes on, to draw on, whatever they do. But I have them not sit in the back row. So if they're sitting in other rows, I can watch students behind them, because when the other students are off onto some other thing, that draws these other students behind them their attention, and then I know immediately that they're off task.
My answer to that is I don't stand in the front of the room. I walk around the room. So, and they'll know when you're coming, and if they're on Facebook, they'll get off quickly and pretend that they're on task at least. And, I mean, I don't teach any classes over 50, so you can get around to that many students. And if you have an extra large classroom, I hope that you have at least one assistant that can be wandering around.
Now, from my interaction with our users, the college professors using our interactive digital book, most of them don't have anything to do with the interactive digital book in the class. And I think that's very well. Tell the students, use this book outside the class. In the class, we're focusing on things that I, as the instructor, can provide. At least some of them don't want their students to have a computer in the classroom at all, and I can understand that. But I think the digital book maybe is best used not in the classroom.
So there's a professor at, I think, University of North Florida, Mark Friedenberg, and he advocates a, and I know this doesn't work for everybody, but this is kind of futuristic, but he advocates a kind of an interactive classroom, and he has designs set up, which are very cool, for these classrooms where they have tables for the students, and then they all connect their computers to one large screen, and the instructor then can either show things on that screen or look at what the students are looking at on their computers. Yeah. Which is useful. But this whole thing is kind of snowballing. You know, we're kind of into new territory pedagogically as well as physically in terms of what our learning materials are. And this whole thing about flipped classrooms and what you actually do in the classroom is you know, changing. Are you lecturing in the front and are students taking notes on their computer? Well, maybe that's not happening so much anymore. Maybe the students are engaged in group discussions, or they're working on projects, or they're doing something that's more active, and then what they're doing on their computer is something that makes sense to them within the learning environment.
The classrooms that are set up that way, that have tables with plugs at the tables and multiple screens, those are called scale-up classrooms. If you want to learn more about that, I'm sure you can just Google scale up. Student-centered, active learning, engaged, upside-down pedagogy.
It's okay. Just a couple of thoughts. One was, you were talking about the video that you posted that other instructors looked at, and I have a couple of videos in the pipeline for one of my books. And my plan is to actually put just a little in the corner, a little picture of my book cover with some basic info so that, you know, if other instructors start using the video, they're at least seeing, like, oh, this awesome video is associated with this book. You know, I don't know if that's going to drive sales at all, but, you know, and every little bit helps. And the other thing this makes me think of is there's this app called Duolingo, Duolingo. It's a language learning app that you can get for free. I know it's on iOS. I think it's on Android, too. And it's basically, you talk about the flipped classroom, it's basically a flipped digital learning where it's all evaluation. And at the beginning, you say, I want to learn Spanish. And they're like, okay, we'll do an assessment and see if you know any Spanish. And okay, we'll start you at this level. And then you go through these little chunks, which are maybe 20 questions in a row. And you can get two of them wrong and still pass the level. And at the very beginning, you know, it's introducing you to the concepts by asking you questions and asking you to answer them. And it has some words underlined that, I don't know what that means. You tap it and it shows you the definition. So it lets you either just zip through the questions if they all make sense to you, or ask for the learning you need. And at the beginning, you can actually go and there's a page you can look at that actually kind of explains the concepts verbally. But it's this whole idea. We were just talking about pages before. And this is basically just taking away the explanation and making the content the evaluation, and then allowing students on demand to ask for the explanatory content to go with that rather than the other way around. And I just, whenever I think about digital learning in the future, I think about that because I've used it and it's a really useful tool.
Hi, first I'm a first-time attendee, and I just wanted to thank the panel. If I was looking for the information that you're sharing on my own and not knowing who to trust or where to get it from, it would take a year or more. And so I'm very appreciative of the value and wisdom coming from all of you. I have two questions. One, June, I wanted to follow up. You mentioned TLDR, too long, didn't read, and we're talking about attention span. And you mentioned, if I heard you correctly, 10 editions ago, a publisher had suggested a picture a page. And I wanted to know if that was what you would suggest as well. Is that a, you know, I was asking Al earlier, is there a formula for picture graphic per page? And I know you threw out that as a publisher recommendation, but is there a best practice or what you would recommend?
That's a good question. I don't know if there is a best practice. Some of our editors in here, best practice.
If you're an editor, find me after, please.
Yeah, yeah, okay. So, yeah, that, good question, and I don't know. I mean, I have followed that advice and tried to put something visual on every page ever since then, at least one thing.
Yeah, I've got just one comment about that. We know, or educational studies have indicated that if it's a page full of text, students will often just skip that. And as an author, that just horrifies me. It's like, no, that's important stuff. So there were facing pages in my book, and it was discussing Law of the Sea. And there were no pictures. You know, what's a picture of the law kind of a thing? Is there a police person that's standing there? I don't know. So my editor looked at that and said, we need a picture on here. So I'm reading it going, oh, my God, this is the hardest task I've ever had for my book, trying to find a picture. And there's something called the three-mile territorial sea, and that was set up based on how far cannons can shoot from shore. So there it was. I now have a picture of a cannon on that facing pages that shows, you know, how this was initially set up. So that's what's difficult about it, is actually finding some things that might relate to a topic that is just expressed in words.
So in a former life, I was an editor, and I always used to work with authors. And I would say, trust your gut. I mean, you teach, and you work with students more than your editor. And I would say, trust your gut, and then review it with the market quite heavily. And the market will tell you, and actually what's great now, from when I was an editor, it was all paper. We can get really quick data very fast with volumes of not only instructors, but ask your publishing house to include students, because that's helpful information that will help the manuscript in the production, but also on the marketing side. You'll have a really good story to tell the market that you involve students in not only the potential, you know, strategy around pictures, but all kinds of other pedagogical elements. But it's a great question. I don't think there's a magic silver bullet answer.
I don't know. I don't think so. But there is one thing. If you want to put a picture or an image on every page, you can't put a fluff image on a page. And how do you tell if the image is a fluff image or not? Okay. Yeah. If you can't put a call out on it that adds value, or an arrow on it to identify something that's going to be useful for the students, then that picture is not a good one.
For online courses, has anybody attempted to fully integrate a digital book with a learning management system so that would be interactive and like the Duolingo model, so to speak? I'm not aware. I've seen bits and pieces. I just have a book, for instance, where the videos are SCORM compliant. They automatically upload, but that's one little tiny piece. I could envision in the future all of it being integrated and interactive. But anybody know of anything that's that mature down the road that's been developed?
Well, the MindTap thing is going to be like that. But if you run, because there's a lot of technical issues related to SCORM and LMSs versus like Tin Can and Experience API. So I think it should be feasible within an LMS as long as all the content is coming from within that LMS. Where you run into trouble there is if you wanted to have something running on a tablet, LMSs just don't like to get data from outside, and that's where you have to go to a totally different environment, which is why I look at it. Tin Can Experience API is looked at. It's the next generation SCORM, and it's made by the same people that designed SCORM and LMSs and said they couldn't really extend it anymore. So I think some of these things will get much easier if we move past LMSs. Yeah, because LMSs have some severe limitations. There are some issues there. But I think the you guys might know, but the MindTap system was, they're trying to do that within the limitations of an LMS-type system.
Yeah, so those systems all include some sort of way to distribute content and then get results back to instructors. All right, that, I mean, that's sort of the...
To that system.
But then, you know, when you talk about LMS, Dan and I had an argument about this the other day because he looks at LMS in a very technical term as it being a SCORM-compliant system. When I, as an instructor, think about LMS, I think about a learning management system, and I think about it in a very non-technical way, which is the students are doing something out there, and I can get information about what the students are doing over here. You know, I look at it in a very general sense. Okay, and so, for example, Dan is working on a system right now that's pretty much all in place where information from tablets that are not connected to the internet, as soon as they connect, can go somewhere. If you're online, on, you know, anywhere in the cloud, that information, you're a student, your information, your results can go to your instructor or to a publisher. So if you kind of think of a little spider web, right, and the students with their devices are at the ends here of the spider web, all their results, all their activity kind of goes into this middle little hub, and then it can be distributed back out to instructors, to the publisher, to administrators, or wherever. So those systems, there is at least one system that does that, a very complete sort of interrelated content distribution and result system available, and others I think are working on it. That, you know, that's kind of the holy grail at this point.
I have a second question. It's about digital exploration. And the gentleman on my right who teaches engineering was mentioning that textbooks are valuable as a professional. I had a student who sent me an email maybe 3 weeks after my course ended saying, I can't access my digital textbook, and I politely explained that it had expired. And she sent a reply saying, but it was such great information, and I can't, how do, you know, I didn't have the heart to tell her that she would legally have to purchase it again in order to get that information. So. Anyway, the question was, Al, I was intrigued by your 18-month, because it seems to me like the standard is either the length of the course or semester or quarter. I'm curious how you landed on 18 months, and any previous discussion or, you know, I assume that that expiration for digital textbooks is based on piracy or fear of piracy, which I completely get. On the other hand, as a student, I want to be able to use that information later on.
Yeah, so initially, it wasn't my decision. It was my publisher's decision. Initially, when the book first comes out, it's a six-month subscription, and that's more typical. But now that my book's been out for a couple years, they expanded that to 18 months. And for many of my students, they really do appreciate that longer time frame in which they can access the book.
I've been a textbook author for 30 years, gone through 9 editions, and I'm very interested. That's one of the reasons I'm here. The question is our future, our income as authors dependent upon will the publishers succeed in offsetting the problem of the growing used book textbook market to go digital, and I've been reading, Shannon recommended a book to me that was dubious about that question on, what was the name of that book?
Naomi Barron,
yeah. So I gather that from what you're saying here today, you're optimistic about it, our future, and they're continuing to contribute. But what bothers me is that all this time, we've been doing it as a labor of love because we love it. I know that's just it. But we've been taken for granted by educational institutions, and that consider we write a book that is just like a novel or anything else. You should get it the cheapest price that you can. And instructors encourage students to buy secondhand books or to not to buy, to adopt textbooks at all. But it seems to me that here we are thinking about providing them even, I mean, your question you were asked is that you think instructors are okay with online courses, they'll keep their jobs. But what about us? I mean, we provide, what we provide is that we give them a classroom tutor, classroom bank of exams, and now the list goes on, that we help them, the cost of it, providing an extra instructor for the classroom, and we train new instructors, and yet we're not considered an educational expense on their part. It's up to the students to pay. And this problem is still not solved when we're thinking now about providing even more elaborate digital resources for them to use. So how do you deal with this existential situation that we're faced with?
I know these guys are going to have many things to say about this, I'm pretty sure. But I'd say that I don't think digital is necessarily going to solve that problem. It's going to raise additional problems. And I think I'd say I'm optimistic, but I'm also kind of worried.
I'm just going to say I never thought about it that way, but thank you for bringing that up. Let's give another perspective.
No, that's amazing because I had actually never thought of that either, that the institution, we are a resource for the institution as well as for the students. And actually, I mean, the institution, at least until the advent of digital books, the college bookstores were making, you know, bundles off of selling these books. So really great, very interesting, provocative point.
We only have a few minutes left, and so we probably only have time for a couple more questions unless people want to stay on. I know, Mark.
Mark's been desperately trying to get his in.
So. Mark, wait, let's bring the microphone over.
As someone that's been desktop publishing for 15 plus years and authored a couple books and hearing about all the digital, the attention span of the people using the books obviously is reduced greatly. And we've talked about the amount of pictures or objects in it, and it needs to be not fluff but quality. The one thing I didn't hear about was enough white space also. I look at a lot of books out there, and there's not enough white space. The eyes need to rest. And it's, you can have a lot of stuff in there and a lot of pictures, but if the student doesn't get a chance to rest their eyes on the page, they'll just gloss over it, and they won't learn a lot of things.
And strangely, like if you go digital, pages cost you nothing. So we really should be able to lay out nice pages and not worry about white space. There's no cost.
I have just a brief comment based on the length of time that a digital book is available. My publisher, Elsevier, has all of their digital books. Once you buy it, you buy it for the life of, I guess, digital media or whatever. And I don't know if they change platforms, if they're going to convert. But I would encourage all, and I have several Elsevier books written by other authors that I refer to occasionally. And I not only get lifetime access to it, but when it gets updated, like reprint type stuff, not a new edition, I'd have to buy that again, but updates to that edition I can keep. So I have like three or four editions of some books if I really want that new edition. But that's something that we could all encourage the publishers with what little power we have to go toward that model, because I think that benefits students, especially in those of us that teach courses where they need that basic information later on in other courses or even in their career.
I think part of the concern on the publisher has to be if it's online and access is by user ID password, if the book is available indefinitely, that user ID and password is available indefinitely, you could give that to 1,000 other students, so piracy becomes an issue. If there's some other way of limiting use, then they wouldn't be so worried about it.
The way they limit that is they do look at what device it's on, and you are limited in your devices. So, but, I mean, there's ways around that,
yeah,
too.
Yeah.
I wanted to add one more comment to what Mark was saying. So in preparation for this panel, I was looking around for studies and this kind of thing, and there's actually an interesting study. Unfortunately, it was done on novels and not on textbooks, but there was a study done on – using a paper version of a novel versus an e-reader like a Kindle, and, you know, how much somebody would remember about the book if they were touching it and holding it versus reading it electronically. And it turned out that physically holding the book actually adds to the experience of remembering the information. And I would love to see that study replicated in textbooks. and the other piece was that the Kindle Lite was also affecting the person reading the book. So that now there's a Kindle white light or paper white. That's why, because that light that comes out of a Kindle is apparently distracting or stressful.
I think we're about out of time.
We are out of time. I am going to let her ask her last question, but then we're going to have to end. It's been really terrific. There have been so many questions and so much interest in this session. But maybe the rest of you, if you have any questions, you can always go up and talk to them later on or at the hospitality suite tonight.
As digital publishing really becomes the way of the future, I think that one thing that we all have to be concerned about, and I don't think the publishers are, to be honest, is the potential educational divide that it creates. Because when students have access to your book only when they are online, especially if you have students at a community college who are, a lot of them are there for financial reasons, you have a lot of students who don't have internet at home, don't have computers at home. And so while teachers or institutions may say, or even the publishers will tell faculty, well, you know, the students can go to the computer lab and they can read the book online at the computer lab and they can do their homework at the computer lab, while in theory that's true, in reality it might not work so well if you have, for example, a single mom of three kids working full-time who can barely get to school to take your class, and now that student is being required to come to campus or go to the library or go wherever to be able to use a digital textbook. And, you know, no one kind of spoke to that, and I, as a math author, that really bothers me. That really, really bothers me when my publisher just wants to push digital, digital, digital. And I think that a lot of students are getting lost in that problem.
Yeah, I think that's a concern. I also worry about the parity between paper and digital because they have mixed use. But the problem might start to go away as digital devices become less expensive. Again, our partners are doing quite a bit, like in India. And a $30 tablet, which can then run multiple books, it turns out that the digital version can be cheaper than the paper versions. And so it'll start to change.
Or New York, where you have large populations of students who are from impoverished backgrounds, they are not going to have internet access. And all I'm saying is that I believe that is a concern that somebody needs to keep in mind as they are adopting digital textbooks. I personally think it should be an option for students, or if you're at a school that's big enough, you designate these classes are sort of traditional. These classes are going to use online books, online homework systems, to at least give those students a choice, because otherwise I do think you are creating a bigger educational divide than even exists today.
And there is another option, though, is that running on the inexpensive tablets, they can save the results, meaning run completely locally offline, sending results only when you get an internet connection. Because one of the models we've talked about is some people only get to a village every 3 or 4 weeks. They would do the homework at home, save all the results. Occasionally, they'd be able to send their data in. So there's many, some of these have technological solutions, but it is an issue.